Weintraub Syncopators, Germany's hottest jazz band in the 1930s, with one of their big hits, something about a gorilla with a villa in the zoo.
Mein Gorilla hat ne Villa im Zoo. Mein Gorilla lebt zufrieden und froh. Kennt keine Politik
und es ist sein höchstes Glück,
die Gemahlin zu jucken. Und auf jeden, der ihn stört, aus der Villa ganz empört,
voll Verachtung zu spucken.
Mein Gorilla.
The Weintraub Syncopators were Jews, musicians of extraordinary skill, not just players, but singers and comedians. When the Nazis took power, they left, ending up eventually, of all places, in Sydney in 1937, where the band was for a time acclaimed, but then broken, a little by the war and a lot by the musicians' union, terrified these foreign musicians might take Australian jobs, not just in jazz bands, but symphony orchestras. Frankly, these men played too well. 4 years ago, the musicologist Albrecht Dümmling wrote an account of the band's rise and fall under the inevitable title, Mein Gorilla hat ne Villa im Zoo. Now, an English translation of the book has appeared under the rather more straightforward banner. From Berlin to Sydney, the Weintraub Syncopators' Jazz Legacy, 1924 to 1940. And Albrecht Dümmling joins me from Berlin. Welcome back to Late Night Live.
Thank you very much.
Now, we're sitting in a Berlin club in 1932, and the Weintraub Syncopators appear on stage. Albrecht, what would we expect to see and hear?
They were not exactly playing in clubs, but in great theatres like the Wintergarten, which was a big revue theater, and there they appeared with an enlarged group with 10 members, because it was a huge stage, and they appeared playing variations on a pop song in different styles. Once as a Bavarian type of music, then as a foxtrot, then in Oriental style. And at that time, the arranger was Franz Waxman, who later played a major role in the film industry in Hollywood. But important was that they changed the instruments while playing, so everyone, each member, could play at least 7 instruments. They could also sing, and this was very special, the tempo of the show and the changing of the instruments and of styles.
And they were also comedians.
They were comedians, yes. They acted, they had boxing games with instruments. They played sometimes while lying on the ground, so they could do everything.
Was this Jewish jazz?
This was never mentioned until 1932. It's true that the majority of the group, with the exception of Freddie Weiss, the saxophone player, who was American, they were Jewish, but they were not religious at all. Only very late, in an internment camp, Stefan Weintraub spoke for the first time about his Jewish background. But one could say that maybe Jews were very interested already, Jewish artists were interested in jazz coming from America. If you think of Erwin Schulhoff incorporated jazz rhythms into classical music, or Darius Milhaud. But Stefan Weintraub and Horst Graf never spoke about their Jewish background, and it was not mentioned in the public until the first time, I think it was 1932, in Freiburg, when it was indirectly mentioned that they were Jewish,
yes.
But indirectly only.
But it mattered for Weintraub, didn't it? Because he came from a family of cantors.
Yes, he came from a family of cantors. His father was a businessman who moved to Berlin. He was born in Breslau as a son of a businessman, and his grandfather was a cantor, but he was absolutely non-religious. Stefan he moved to Berlin in 1922 and worked in the pharmaceutical business first, but was a hobby musician who had already bought a big grand piano in Breslau, in his hometown in Silesia. But he never spoke about religion, and interesting enough, they also did not mention the term of exile, of refugees. They didn't want. They said, we are successful musicians who are just going on tour. And only once in 1933, there was an interview in The Hague, in Den Haag, in Holland, where they said, "We are now in exile like Friedrich Holler, like Friedrich Holländer." This was the only time when this was mentioned. So even the term exile was not mentioned, and Jewish even less. And this came about for the first time in 1942, when Stefan Weintraub was in the camp, in the internment camp in Tatura.
Shall we get to that? Because I wanted to ask you about Berlin before the Nazis came to power.
Yeah.
Because this new young jazz band played the soundtrack for Marlene Dietrich's Blue Angel. How did that happen?
Yeah, the Blue Angel, this was the first film for which Friedrich Holländer wrote the film music. This was his start into the film music. The Weintraubs had already played in several other short films, experimental films, with Rudolf Nelson, I think just 9-minute film. The Blue Angel, this was a major film, and we know that Marlene Dietrich was accepted only in the very last moment at the main figure. There were other actors.
Oh, really?
Directors liked others much more. But then the director, Josef von Sternberg, preferred Marlene Dietrich. And they were invited by Friedrich Holländer to participate, the Weintraub Festival participate. And Friedrich Holländer had done with them together in the revue theaters, wonderful revues. First, he had only played the piano in these revues, which were titled very successful. And then he introduced the Weintraubs, and then it became even more successful in the theaters at the Kurfürstendamm. And so he also invited them to join him in the film, Der Blaue Engel, The Blue Angel, where they appear on stage in this theater, this very simple theater for sailors called Der Blaue Engel, the Blue Angel. And there they appeared.
And there they are.
The film was not very often to be seen, but they play the well-known tunes sung by Marlene Dietrich.
Identification, this is an interview with Stefan Weintraub, recorded in Sydney on the 4th of June, 79. End of ident. We'll go in 10 seconds. Tell me a little bit about life in Berlin at the time you were making The Blue Angel.
Well, life in Berlin at that time was marvellous. It was even, in my opinion, and many others' opinion, better than in Paris and New York, because it was partly more intimate, partly more international. Berlin had about 50 theaters and varietés and cabarets and so on. For instance, Friedrich Holländer had a few reviews in cabarets going. They were always sold out, topical reviews. And people spent money.
Be careful when you meet a sweet blonde stranger. You may not know it, but you are greeting danger. You try in vain, you can't explain the charming, alarming blonde women.
Albrecht, why did the Nazis not like jazz? Why did they disapprove of jazz?
That's a very interesting, very important question. Jazz was for them a mixture of so-called Negro music, American music, foreign music, and black music. They wanted to a racial pure art. They wanted to purify the German culture, put away all foreign influences, which was absolutely nonsense, since we know that already Johann Sebastian learned a lot from Italy, from French. And it was incredible, impossible. And as we know, the jazz was a mixture of different cultures. It was a mixture of African rhythms, of harmonies from the chorals, from the Christian chorals, and from working songs, mostly from the black slaves. It was a mixture, and
it It wasn't German enough.
Lively. It was not German enough, exactly. Interesting enough, Goebbels liked the music, but it didn't fit with his concept of purification of German art.
The band was on tour. They'd left for a tour for Prague and other European countries in 1933 and decided that they could not go back. Now, I know that there's a complex story about where they went and the tours they went and sort of finally ending up in Japan. Why did they choose to come in 1937 to come to Australia? Why not the United States? Why not somewhere else? Why Australia?
Yeah, this developed gradually. They were quite a long time. They were half a year in Italy, and then they had incredible success in the Soviet Union. It was prolonged. It was more than a year. And they played in all parts of the Soviet Union, at the Black Sea and in Erevan. And really, they toured around. And then they got an invitation to Manchuria, to Harbin. And so they traveled on with the Siberian train to Harbin. And there, their manager was Henry Barger, quite interesting man with his own story.
The manager of the band.
The manager of the group, Henry Barger. And he traveled ahead and came then to Japan. And he did not mention that he was excluded from Germany. He impressed the Japanese by mentioning that he came from Berlin and said, "Oh, you are from Berlin, wonderful. Because we Japanese planned the next Olympic Games." This was 1936, when exactly the successful Olympic Games were going on in Berlin. And they planned their Olympic Games for Tokyo in 1940. So they explained to him, "You can help me." Great. He did never mention that he was excluded, that he himself was Jewish and that the members were Jewish. And then he got an invitation somehow to appear, which was not so far away, to Australia, so via Shanghai and Singapore and Java, and finally they ended up in Western Australia and ended up in Sydney.
What brought you and the Vine Tribes to Australia?
I remember when we were in Czechoslovakia, we got an offer from Russia. And we accepted it because it was a good offer. Had great success there. And from there, we went to Japan. But from then on, we didn't know where to go. We didn't want to go back to Europe. So there were a few American film agents that they said, "Why don't you go to Australia? That's a good country, and I'm sure you will have a great success there." That's what we did. He went here, made a contract with a firm, Snyder and Dean, which were the forerunners of Hoyts.
This was quite a normal thing at the time. Before the talkies came, there were orchestras in some film palaces, and so there were places where a band could play, and it was used that before the film there would be live music, and this was to happen in Australia as well.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the musicologist Albrecht Dümmling about his book, From Berlin to Sydney, The Weintraub Syncopators' Jazz Legacy, 1924-1940. So, Albrecht, they arrived in Australia, first in Perth, then they came to Sydney, and their debut, I think, was a big concert in the Mayfair Theatre in Castlereagh Street in Sydney.
Exactly. But it was connected with a film show because the organiser was a film company. But it was a great success, and the Sydney Morning Herald wrote, "It was incredible speed, how they changed the music. This was a great success."
And then they took a tour, and to imagine this band in Katoomba, Dubbo, Bathurst, Parkes and Orange is just extraordinary. And I presume that in each of those towns, they were playing again in picture theatres.
And the reason why they went to these smaller towns was because there was polio infection in Melbourne and in Victoria. So they had to go to these smaller places, which was not originally planned. In the advertisings, it said, coming directly from great successes in London and Paris, which was not true. They came from Moscow and Tokyo. And Berlin was not mentioned. This was interesting. Paris, London, and New York.
But already the Australian Musicians Union was not happy with the appearance of these foreign musicians. Why did the Musicians Union object to them playing?
At the beginning, they didn't object because they said, we are on a world tour. We will continue to South Africa and then going on to South America. And perhaps they had even the idea to continue, not to stay on in Australia. But then already a few months later, Stefan Weintraub said, I think we couldn't go on for years and years since they had left Germany already 4 years ago. So they applied for allowance to stay on in Australia. And once the union heard about that, that they wanted to stay on, then the difficulties arose. They had no objections on a tour, but they didn't want at all a group that settled in Australia.
Was this because Australian musicians, with the arrival of the talkies, were losing those jobs in picture theatres?
Yes, they had lost a lot of jobs in picture theatres, and they wanted to give them these jobs. And they said, we have enough musicians who could do the same, which was not true. They had some jazz bands who could play jazz, that's true. But they had not musicians who could play in such a virtuosic manner and with as comedians as the Weintraubs did.
At that time, a new restaurant was about to open in Sydney, and a restaurant which in time became very famous. It was called Prince's, and the band got a job there. But what happened to that job?
The owner of the restaurant wanted to have the best band, and so he went around the country and listened to bands. And there was Craig Crawford, an Australian band originally coming from New Zealand. And then he preferred the Weintraub Syncopators. But the press connected to the Musicians Union and to the business said, you certainly prefer the local band. The others are not union members. And they applied to be union members, but they were never accepted. So the Prince's Restaurant had to take Craig Crawford's band in the main evening, the main performances. And only after midnight, when the Australians had their meal, then the Weintraubs were allowed to play.
Though they were playing on the radio.
There it was much more easy to play on private radio. There they played, and there they also were singing, and they were extremely popular. And there the union had no influence. This was independent. Also interesting enough that in these newspapers there were advertisings from instrument makers for the Weintraub Syncopators, and the union did not like this.
Yes. So the war broke out, but even after the war, the band was able to play at charity concerts. Though the union might complain, they played at charity concerts, including in early 1940 at Yarralumla for the Governor-General, Lord and Lady Gowrie.
Yes, this was a very special event, and this, of course, created hate among the union, especially their secretary, Frank Kitson, and he did everything to say that this was impossible, and wrote to the wife of the, who was it, Lady
Gowrie. Lady Gowrie.
Lady Gowrie, yes. And this was really very hard that he said, they don't need this, and it's a shame that you occupy foreigners.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Albrecht Dümmling, author of this remarkable and challenging book about the fate of the Weintraub Syncopators in Australia. Albrecht, in 1940, the whole band was denounced by a man called William Buchan. Who was he, and why did anybody believe him?
Yes, William Buchan, he was a businessman who had worked for a while in Shanghai and also visited the Soviet Union. And he said he had seen with his own eyes that band members were accused of spionage in Leningrad. and that a band member, they had taken the plans of a sea fortress in Leningrad, and only with the help of the German consul, they had to leave quickly the Soviet Union. And the Australian secret services believed him, and I could never understand why he did this until I saw the ship's list of the Gorg and the ship Gorgon, which took the wine shops from Singapore to the Australian west coast. And there was the brother of William Wacken, and he was in the same business. So I think he must talk to his brothers that they were on board, that there was a group of musicians on board with very beautiful ladies. And these were the ladies accompanying the Weintraubs. It was a male band, but they had female followers, which later on married the band. And there was certainly a sort of envy. They were on board of this ship, and he must have talked to his brother. And so the British authorities in Australia believed him that, in fact, the Weintraubs were spies, which, of course, they were not. And this meant that then the Australian police went to the apartments of the Weintraubs and inquired them, but never mentioned ever that they were accused of being spies.
Yes. How big was the band at this point? How many members? How many musicians?
There were seven musicians.
Seven musicians. But only three of them were actually then rounded up and interned. Weintraub himself, Graf, and a man who at that stage was called Kaiser, but he later changed his name to Kay.
Yeah,
and those three were taken down to the internment camp out on the Hay Plain, and they were thrown in with Nazis. Now, how long were they there before they were allowed back out again?
They were there 1.5 years even. And Stefan Weintraub wrote several letters to the command and said, I have no idea why I am interned here. Is it simply because I'm a German citizen? He had a German passport. Also, Kaiser was interned because the authorities believed that he was a German citizen. He was born in Leipzig. But in fact, he was a Peruvian citizen.
Of all things, a Peruvian.
His parents came from Callao, which is the port of Lima, the capital of Peru in South America. So he complained, and then he was already released a bit earlier, Sidney John Kay, originally John Kurt Kaiser. But there was a third one who was not Leon White. Weiss, Leon Weiss, he also had a German passport, but somehow he evaded the authorities. He was not interned, but Stefan Weintraub and Horst Graf were interned in Tatura, in the Tatura camp, and even they were in Camp 1, which was called the Nazi camp, where they elected as a camp leader a Nazi. And so in the camp, they celebrated the birthday of Adolf Hitler on the 20th of April. They made this Nazi salute. So this was terrible, of course, for them. And they were accused that the Germans had not won the First World War because of the Jewish influence.
Yes, that.
And so they, of course, they complained, and after a few months, they were put in another camp. But this was a very hard time in Camp 1 in Tatura.
Did they play music at all?
No. As far as I know, no. They had their instruments were also confiscated. They were had to leave.
But Albrecht, that was only wise. I mean, the damage those instruments could do to the war effort. It was a good idea to take them away.
They were taken to the camp because of they were German citizens, so they were enemy aliens. Whereas the other members of the band were mostly Polish or English. One was born in South Africa. The two Frischer brothers, they were Polish, although born in Berlin, were Polish citizens. But Stefan Weintraub was born in Berlin as a German citizen.
Of course.
So was Horst Graf.
So when Graf Weintraub and Kaiser were released from internment, they discovered, of course, that a couple of the members of the band had joined their competition, the Crawford Band. So the band was split and was never reunited.
It was never reunited. They founded, the other remaining members founded a new group called Fischer's Sextet with three Australians, because it was necessary to join with Australians. So this was Fisher Sextet, but this was not long. They played for a while, but then they had to join the Australian Army. Then the band also, this band ended up. And Stefan Weintraub wanted to found a new group and went to Prince's Restaurant, and he was not accepted because even then the Musicians Union objected that he would ever play again. So he went to the second restaurant just in
Romano's, the famous Romano's.
Romano's.
Does that mean that after the war you didn't get back together again as a group?
No. Three of us who had not German passports stayed at Prince's as a trio, and when the others came back, we played for a while at Romano's, if you remember that, and then slowly it wound itself up.
There he played for just a while, and then again the union. Then there was a very bad event. Then the journal Truth published an article saying that Stefan Weintraub was the proud owner of a cross given to him by the Deutsche Kaiser Wilhelm. In fact, Stefan Weintraub had served in the First World War and had got a medal. And this, when this was mentioned during the war, of course, this was the end of his musical career.
Albrecht, I can't resist this. I've got that Truth article in front of me. It begins, "Sydney Cafe Society, titled people and wealthy playabouts have developed a distinct fondness for foreign musicians and entertainers, according to Mr. Frank Kitson, Secretary of the Musicians' Union. He says his union intends to conduct a vigorous campaign against these foreigners and also against those who sponsor and employ them. Quote, some people who consider themselves among the most important citizens in the state have become the champions and supporters of numerous aliens, some of them enemy aliens, who are getting plum musical and stage employment." So, Albrecht, Weintraub never played again.
Weintraub's never played again. This was the end of the band. And also, Stefan Weintraub ended up to be a professional musician as well in Horst Graf. They worked as mechanics in a wire company and had very different fates. Stefan Weintraub played the piano sometimes for the little Viennese theater where they restaged the Three Penny Opera, but otherwise he earned his money as a mechanic in a company, in the industry.
Of the whole of the band, only Leo Weiss, who became Leo White, and John K. Kaiser, who became John K., they continued to play music. Cyril Schulwater opened a hamburger joint.
Yes, yes. An interesting case is Sidney John Kay, because he fought against the union and he won. He became a member of the union and never used this membership. This was his victory in 1944.
He had to go to court, and the court ordered.
He went to court and became a member.
And so this great musical group, this hot jazz band, just sort of sank into the Australian dirt.
Exactly. Very sad.
But you've lived now in Australia for something like 40 years.
Yeah.
You found something in this country to hold you.
Ah, definitely. Mm. Nearly everything. Only I didn't lose my German accent.
Very sad. Albrecht, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking to Albrecht Dümmling, author of From Berlin to Sydney, The Weintraub's Syncopators Jazz Legacy, 1924 to 1940. It's published by Peter Lang. This is Late Night Live.